If I hear a police siren at any point, I kill him. Understand? I need you to look at the files again. Amy, says Jeff, through clenched teeth, you're wrong. Too late, Jeff, says Amy. Let's go. Jeff's checklist came good in the end. Point 6. Act decisively. The next 10 minutes will tell her everything she needs to know. Chapter 92. Rob Kenner reaches the 9th tee. You got any isotonic water? He asks his caddy. I've only got normal, and I can't drink that because of all the oestrogen in it. Of course Rob's caddy has isotonic water. She hands a bottle to him. Rob hits his tee shot right, flirting with the deep rough that lines the fairway. He gives a sigh of relief as it pulls up short of a thick line of trees. He's avoided some trouble there. Rob prefers playing with other people, but there's not always the option, is there? Nelson Nunez will be here tomorrow, and he plays, so that'll be nice. Bit of golf, bit of business. And it's nice to be able to think from time to time. He needs to cut ties with Lube. He understands that Lube has to stay under the radar, but really, if you're doing business with someone, you have to be able to look them in the eye once in a while. You have to protect yourself. Rob reaches his ball and asks his caddy for a 9-iron. That should do it. No breeze today, so just float it up there. He can see it in his mind's eye, landing dead centre on the green, curling down a little towards the hole. Doesn't always work that way, but lovely when it does. Makes everything else worthwhile. His caddy starts whistling. Rob gives her a glare. When has she ever whistled before? You bored? Sorry, boss, she says. Long, red ponytail, swinging in the light breeze. She probably is bored, to be fair. She came to him via Mickey and via Davy before that. She was just a caddy, but Rob has given her more responsibilities. She's been around the world a fair bit recently. She's the only person Rob trusts to meet and greet his targets. She knows his business. He's even asked her if she'd fancy turning her hand to the actual killing at some point, but it's not for her. She whistles again. Rob raises his palms to her in objection, then settles behind the ball. There is a rustle in the trees on his backswing, so Rob begins his setup again. Lots of stray cats living in these woods. He has started his backswing when the first shot rings out. It hits him full in the chest. He drops his club and staggers backwards. There's someone in the trees. Okay, yeah, there's smoke too. Rob falls to his knees. Someone is screaming. He thinks it must be his caddy, but he can see her running in the distance, red hair flowing behind her. So it must be him. More gunshots. A figure emerges from the bushes and, pointing a shotgun, looks down at him. And so it is that, just before the final gunshot, Rob Kenner finally gets to look Francois Lube in the eye. Chapter 93. Rosie had thought it was the boy from room service. She hadn't actually ordered anything from room service, but she had winked at him in the hotel lobby earlier, so when she'd heard the knock at the door, she just assumed. She had forgotten, however, that she has recently entered a world where knocks at hotel doors are not always lovers. Sometimes they are assassins. Rosie invites Eddie Flood in, because what other option does she have? Perhaps she can talk him round, and if not, well, what a story. She doesn't know where Steve is, but he'll piece together what's happened here. I'm sorry to disturb you, Rosie, says Eddie. Bit late for that, Eddie, says Rosie. I wanted to be ready, says Eddie. Before we met. Eddie reaches into his bag for a gun. Rosie reasons that her time may be up. Not for the first time today.
"You'll answer one question, I hope," says Rosie.
"A question?" says Eddie.
"Of course.
Who hired you to kill me?"
"Kill you?" says Eddie, hand in his bag, looking genuinely perplexed.
"You're a hitman?"
"No," says Eddie.
"Well, I mean, yes. But define hitman, you know?"
"You tried to shoot my friend Amy," says Rosie. "You were working for Rob Kenner?"
"Rob?" says Eddie. "I mean, I suppose so. I took his money."
"And you kill people," says Rosie, not unreasonably, in her view.
"Used to," says Eddie. "Even then, only once or twice. And only if they deserved it."
"So if you're not a hitman," says Rosie, "what are you?"
Eddie looks embarrassed.
"You've been following us around the world, so you must have a reason," says Rosie.
"I wanted to talk to you, you see," says Eddie, "as soon as I heard your name. I knew it was my chance to meet you."
"So you're a crazed fan?" Rosie asks.
"I'm not a hitman, and I'm not a crazed fan."
Eddie pulls his laptop out of his bag.
"So sorry I worried you. I'm a writer."
Rosie stares at him.
"I've used the last couple of days, you know, on the planes and what have you, to finish a book I've been working on."
"Uh-huh," says Rosie.
"So it's all good," says Eddie, smiling. "I'm not here to kill you. I just want you to read my book."
"Oh, God, Eddie," says Rosie, putting her hand on his arm. "That's so much worse."
Chapter 94. Steve is in a contemplative mood as he walks along the quayside of Dubai Marina. Here he is, 3,000 miles from home, from the sofa that's been moulded into the shape of his backside, from the creak on the third step of the stairs, and the picture of Debbie that smiles at him from the bedside table.
He yearns for all this, physically aches, to be able to shut his own front door, to shut out the world, to get out of the sun. The Irish pub is up ahead. It will have British sport and British beer, but it won't be the Brass Monkey with Tony and Jyoti and John. There probably won't even be a quiz. It's a small life, Steve realises, that he has wrapped himself up in, small and getting smaller. A man in a suit on a yacht shouts at a woman in a dress on a night out. Has he enjoyed himself, wonders Steve, as he enters the Irish pub? Enjoyed this race across the world? The pub is very noisy, but then everywhere seems to be noisy now. He supposes that Axley is noisy too, but it's his noise, so he doesn't notice it. What Steve doesn't like, increasingly as he gets older, is the noise of other people. So has he enjoyed himself? Answer the question, Steve. Has he enjoyed seeing new things, meeting new people, buying new shorts? Enjoy is the wrong word. Steve scans the busy bar. There are large flashing signs everywhere saying, "Enjoy the crack," and "Irish eyes are smiling." Steve has very recently been in a couple of actual Irish pubs, and he doesn't remember any neon signs. He doesn't remember a barman rolling a diamond-encrusted golden bottle of vodka up his arm and across his shoulder, either. There are huge television screens hanging from the ceiling, all showing sport, the commentators and the graphics competing with each other. There's an awful lot of basketball. Again, Steve doesn't ever recall a lot of basketball talk in actual Ireland. Try as he might, though, Steve cannot find any screen showing the snooker. There's some Premier League football, and Steve sees that it is raining in England. He really can't wait to get back.
Yes, enjoy is the wrong word. Steve hasn't enjoyed himself since Debbie died. Enjoyment is not how he measures his life anymore, so the question is unfair. Is he glad? That's a better question. He's glad to have spent some time with Amy, that's certain, glad to have protected her and to have been protected by her. It's not every daughter-in-law who will high-five you when you've shot a drug dealer in a Coldplay t-shirt, is it? He's glad to have met Rosie. Steve has to admit that to himself. And he wonders if he will see her again when this is over. Where will she go? Back to her island? He hopes not. She is wasted on an island. He is glad, he supposes, to have done something, to have made his world bigger, if only for a week. He is glad that he has remembered that he's pretty good at his job, that he can do more than find lost dogs and look at CCTV. Though he is very much looking forward to getting back to doing both. But yes, he's not bad at this. That's why he's here in this pub. And that's why he's thinking about what will happen next, because the end is now in clear sight. Although Steve feels the magnet of Axley beginning to pull him back, he is surprised to feel there's also a part of him resisting this. And at the very moment he sees the person he's been looking for, drinking a pint and talking on his phone, Steve realises what these conflicting forces are. The thing that is pulling him back to Axley is that groove in the sofa. The place that is the very shape of him, the place he has settled into so thoroughly over the years that it fits him exactly. And the thing resisting that pull is remembering that, not so long ago, there were two grooves in that sofa. And one has vanished, as if it was never there. It is not Axley that Steve wants to go back to. It is Debbie. But it is interesting to Steve that, wherever he's travelled, she has been right there with him. It's been nice to show her a bit of the world. She's here now. Steve knows that, as he pulls up a chair and sits down next to Francois Loubet. Chapter 95. Amy has taken a lemon sweatshirt from around her waist and tied it around Jeff's thigh as a tourniquet. Despite the extraordinary pain he must be feeling, Jeff is not screaming. Firstly, because he has too much self-respect, and secondly, because Amy told him she will shoot him if he makes any loud noises. Also, thirdly, because after marching Jeff out of the boardroom, rather than bundling him into a car, she doubled back and put him in Henk's private den, behind the boardroom mirror. So Amy assumes that Jeff is starting to understand that everything is not as it seems. They can see Susan Knox as she is looking through the personnel files on her computer. She won't find anything, says Jeff, voice getting quieter as Amy's gun presses closer to his temple. I know, says Amy. She's not looking at the files. She's deleting the files. Jeff looks over at her. In the boardroom, Susan is making a phone call. Amy says to Jeff, if I put the gun down, do you promise to stay quiet for 1 minute? Jeff nods, then gestures down to the tourniquet. Amy pulls it tighter as the sound of Susan's call comes through the speakers. It's me. I know, but it is an emergency. Yeah, are you in a bar? Can you hear me? Francois. They know it's not Max. No, it's all good. Nothing for you to worry. Amy thinks it's Jeff. Yep, Jeff. She shot him. Oh, I know, that's Amy. Well, I'm going to confirm it for her. We don't have to kill him. I'll explain it all. He'll understand. We can't, Francois. Me or him? Jesus, Jeff's my friend. I'll sort it, Francois. But I said no more killing. I'll need more money. Another 100,000. And this is the last one. The father-in-law? I don't know. Take care. Take care. Jeff looks at Amy. You knew it was Susan?
No, says Amy. I just knew it wasn't me and it wasn't Max, which left you and Susan.
So you shot me?
It could still have been Hank.
Yeah, I suppose so, but it turns out it wasn't, doesn't it? Says Amy. Point six, Jeff. Act decisively. I wanted to see what she would do. If she'd called the police, I'd have known it was you, and if she had called Lube, I'd have known it was her.
Jeff grimaces in pain. He could have just punched me.
Bit of logic and a bit of chaos, says Amy. Seems to have done the trick.
A bit of Steve and a bit of you, says Jeff.
Shall we go and chat to Susan, says Amy, and then maybe get you to a hospital? Jeff nods.
I've got a guy on Harley Street who does all my gunshot stuff.
I didn't hit anything important, says Amy.
But why Susan? Jeff asks.
How long has Susan worked for you, Jeff? Amy asks.
30 years or so, guesses Jeff.
How much does she get paid?
60 grand, says Jeff.
And where does she live? Amy asks.
Hampstead, says Jeff.
How many people do you know who live in Hampstead on 60 grand a year?
She must have been fleecing you for years.
I thought maybe her parents left her the house.
Her parents are alive, Jeff, says Amy. She brought them to the staff picnic last year.
I left early, says Jeff.
You know me and people.
When's her birthday?
Jeff shrugs.
How would I know that?
Yours is the 25th of February, says Amy.
What did you buy her for Christmas?
For Christmas? Jeff asks.
Nothing. She didn't ask for anything.
Amy nods.
And how did she score on your psychopath test?
96, says Jeff. Same as me. That's why she's head of HR.
Amy nods.
What did Hank score?
Like 12 or something, says Jeff.
He's surprisingly sane.
That's why you were a good team, says Amy.
Amy's phone starts to buzz. Looking into the boardroom, she sees that Susan is ringing her. She answers quietly.
Tell me the worst, says Amy.
It's Jeff, says Susan. All of those payments were authorised from his personal laptop, and the emails from Lube were from his own laptop too. He put the whole thing together.
Amy, I'm so sorry I didn't see it sooner.
Okay, says Amy. What should I do? Police?
After everything he's done, Susan says.
I don't know. He killed people, Amy, and for what?
Money? Doesn't he have enough?
Money does unusual things to people, says Amy.
And he was happy to see you die, says Susan. Happy to set you up. Happy to set Max Highfield up.
I think there's only one thing you can do.
Report him to HR.
Kill him, says Susan. You'll have my full support.
Amy puts down the phone and looks at Jeff.
You know, the old Christmas present might have made all the difference.
You have to make people feel appreciated.
Even I know that.
You know, one day I'm going to have to shoot you back, says Jeff.
I know, Skipper, says Amy. And she and Jeff share a hug.
Chapter 96.
So you were Francois Lube all along, Steve says to Mickey Moody, plonking two honest pints of British bitter on the table. Steve has just let Mickey finish a phone call.
Who's Francois Lube?
Asks Mickey, raising his pint an inch in thanks. The world's greatest money smuggler, says Steve.
It's you, eh?
How'd you work that one out then? Laughs Mickey, taking a bit of a leap.
So you're just a good old-fashioned scrap metal dealer from Billericay, says Steve.
Until anyone can prove otherwise, says Mickey.
Which they can't.
You fancy watching the Man City match?
You're sure no one can prove anything? Steve asks.
Deadly sure, says Mickey. And I'd be very careful if I was you.
Oh, Mickey, I've been careful for years now, says Steve. Hasn't got me anywhere. You need to take a risk or two in life, don't you? Mickey laughs and sups his pint.
Amen to that, Steve.
You heard Rob Kenner was killed, says Steve.
Another one gone, says Mickey. I'm running out of mates.
You are, says Steve. Who have you got to talk to now except your wife?
That's enough for me, says Mickey.
Why don't we talk to each other for a bit, says Steve. Couple of old men.
Nah, you're all right, says Mickey. Let's just watch the match.
They're not going to catch you, Mickey, says Steve. You're too good.
Nothing to catch me for, says Mickey.
Steve smiles. Why don't you just tell me something about yourself that's true?
Something that's true?
No comebacks, no recordings, just you and me.
Would be a relief after so many years of lying, no?
The corner of Mickey's mouth goes up. Every criminal wants to tell the truth eventually. Enough of the truth to be seen, but not enough of the truth to be convicted.
Okay, Mickey begins. You asked for it.
At the age of 14, I started to follow the milk carts around. On an old bicycle. I remember the milk carts, says Steve. Different cart, different route every day. I'd steal the pints of milk from Bethnal Green doorsteps and then sell them on later to all the people furious their milk hadn't arrived.
Enterprising, says Steve.
After 2 weeks or so and a nice bit of cash, which went straight into the building society, I got nicked by an off-duty police officer who was coming home from banging someone or other. 5 in the morning, shirt flapping out of his flies. Anyway, I get away with a caution that time. And I took it seriously. I swore I'd never be arrested again. And 54 years later, I'm pleased to say I never have been. Never even had a speeding ticket. And that's the God's honest. Who else can say that?
Me, says Steve.
Mickey laughs. Thing is with the police, you know, they have a radar, and your only job is to stay under it. It's not rocket science.
And you've stayed under the radar? Steve asks.
Mickey shrugs. I've known an awful lot of criminals and some very successful ones too, but one by one, they make mistakes and get arrested. Or they make different mistakes and somebody kills them.
Like you killed Rob Kenner, says Steve. Things were closing in on you a bit.
Careful, Steve, says Mickey. We're just two old fellas having a chat. Don't spoil it.
You had to do it yourself, though, didn't you? Says Steve. Usually when you have people killed, you get Rob to do it for you. But you couldn't hire him to kill himself.
You're a very interesting man. Mr. Stephen Wheeler of Axley, Hampshire, says Mickey. You're wasted in the scented candle business.
So you know who I am, says Steve.
Of course, says Mickey. I've had people looking into you. But you won't find out a thing about me that I don't want you to know.
Steve smiles now. You're one of the richest criminals in the world, Mickey. And I'm just a private eye from a sleepy village. You know I can't prove anything.
Got that right, says Mickey.
But I do know that you're Francois Loubet, says Steve.
You don't know a thing, Steve Wheeler, says Mickey.
God bless you for even trying.
Francois Loubet ordered the deaths of 6 people, says Steve. And he ordered the death of my daughter-in-law. And I believe he shot Rob Kenner around 3 hours ago.
Sounds like a wrong'un, says Mickey, but he's not me.
You think your grandmothers will be proud of you?
Excuse me?
Steve sees Mickey's hackles rise. You think they'd be proud of how you make a living?
You don't talk about them, says Mickey.
Now let's enjoy the football before I have to make another phone call and have you dealt with.
Well, you can't ring Rob Kenner anymore, says Steve.
What are you? Says Mickey, staring at Steve.
Arsenal fan.
Millwall, says Steve.
You think your two grands will be proud that you walked out of your front door this afternoon, walked across a sandy track into a copse by the golf course, big bag in your hand, lay in wait for Rob Kenner, and then shot him dead?
You're delusional, says Mickey.
It's the sun.
And then ran back to the safety of your house before the first siren even sounded, without even zipping the bag back up.
They'd be proud of that, would they?
You know nothing about my nans, says Mickey. Don't try to wind me up, it won't work.
I know something about them, says Steve. I know their names.
Mickey looks at Steve over his pint.
Their names are tattooed on your shoulder blades, says Steve.
Elizabeth and Louisa.
Mickey shakes his head and smiles to himself.
God rest them both, says Mickey.
Lou and Bet, says Steve.
Lou and Bet, repeats Mickey.
He thinks for a long while, then smiles.
That's all you got?
Steve shrugs.
It's just good to know I'm right, that's all. I'm happy I worked it out. And that's why you should always wear a t-shirt in the sauna.
I'll buy the next round, says Mickey.
That's your reward.
I don't want to drink from you, says Steve.
Mickey nods. Let me tell you something, Steve Wheeler. I was raised back and forth between my two grands. My mum died, my dad disappeared. I never asked why, and no one ever told me. But those two women were the making of me.
Lou and Bet, says Steve.
Lou and Bet. They taught me to work hard, to save what you earn, to look after your friends and family, and most of all, never be flash. No one likes a show pony. So I live a quiet life. My villa's got everything I need. Little pool, 30 seconds to the golf course, spare bedrooms for the kids and grandkids to visit. No one is ever going to be knocking at the door asking how I can afford it. The police have looked into me from time to time. Inevitable with the company I've had to keep over the years. But if you have the choice of investigating a man with a Lamborghini or a man who drives a Volvo estate, who do you investigate?
So why do it? Says Steve.
How long have I got left on the planet? 20 years or so? When I die, my son and daughter are going to be very surprised. They'll be expecting to be left a bit, for sure. The villa's worth a few bob. But they won't be expecting 2.6 billion.
Billion, says Steve, smiling.
Family. You'd do anything for them, eh?
I'd do anything for them, says Mickey.
Me too, says Steve. That's why you picked on the wrong person this time.
Mickey laughs. I'll need to keep an eye on you and Amy from now on. But if you leave me be, I'll leave you be.
Afraid not, says Steve. You've killed innocent people and you've tried to kill my daughter-in-law.
It's all business, says Mickey.
Mickey, says Steve. Your family is not more important than my family. I promise I'll leave you alone when you're in prison. Probably Alla Weir, where you had Courtney Lewis killed.
If you say so, old son, says Mickey.
But I'm not sure my tattoos are the killer evidence you think they are.
No, the tattoos just helped me piece it all together, says Steve.
That's how I knew you were Lube. And that's why I was able to get the video evidence.
No one's been videoing me, says Mickey.
No one even photographs me. I'm just a boring old man. No one's watching.
And yet I know you left your house at 2:05 with that long canvas bag and that you returned home a little faster at 2:31, 1 minute after Rob Kenner was shot, canvas bag unzipped, shotgun on show.
Impossible, says Mickey.
I'd have seen if you were hanging around filming me. You're not that good.
No one was hanging around, Mickey, says Steve.
though a bodyguard called Abby's been busy this afternoon.
Riddles, Steve, says Mickey.
No one ever got convicted on riddles.
Well, says Steve, my final question should clear it up for you.
Go on, says Mickey. What's your final question?
Steve drains the last of his pint and places it, carefully, back down on the table.
What sort of doorbell do you have, Mickey?
Chapter 97. You have to change your angle sometimes if you want to see what's right in front of you. On that hot, wet pavement, with his life slowly leaving his body, Archer can finally see it all. There are pools of light from gas lamps, but they're useless against the dark, useless against the shadows that haunt these black streets. Shine as many lights as you want, but Soho, that dirty old town, always has a way of staying hidden. Archer thought he'd had him this time, could taste it like iron and gunmetal. After all those years hunting, there he was, the man people swore was a ghost, right in front of him. This whisper of a man, spiriting himself through the Soho underground of jazz clubs and dive bars, no two people ever seeing the same thing. I've seen the cat, sure. Electric blue suit, three women on his arm. I met the dude once, I'm sure, taller than a doorway, cane tipped with gold. If you ever see him, make sure you unsee him fast. Now that Archer had finally seen him, seen the flesh and blood, he finally understood.
Should I go on? Asks Eddie. Are you bored? Is it bad?
Rosie D'Antonio drapes an arm across Eddie's naked chest. I'm not bored yet, and it isn't too bad yet. You have me where you want me.
You sure? Asks Eddie.
You better hook me quickly, though, says Rosie. So far you're a better lover than a rider.
Eddie looks disappointed.
Buck up, soldier, says Rosie. You're a very, very good lover.
Eddie returns to reading. There are sirens in the distance, normal as birdsong around here, but it's all too late. A woman is kneeling to help him, red dress, kind voice. If Archer could have told her what he finally knew, he would. But cheek on pavement, and the neon lights of the Soho sex shops reflected in the plum-black pool of his own blood, he has already spoken his last words. When he first hit the ground, Archer had seen the man walk away, nice and slow, his whistle echoing along the high alley walls. He saw the man's knife slip from his sleeve and clatter down a storm drain. That's when Archer noticed it. The sole of the man's left shoe. Archer knew, finally, who he was, and knew, finally, why they'd never been able to catch him.
No way, says Rosie.
The sole of his shoe? She motions for Eddie to continue. Would anybody ever catch him? This cool cat killer. Archer's son, Eric Jr., is 2 years into his Met career. Archer knows how this will go. His son or his killer. Only one of them will survive what's to come. The sole of the left shoe. It was all there. And now Archer's son must spend a lifetime finding out what Archer knows, but can no longer say. Eddie closes his laptop. That's just the prologue. Really, just rough.
What does Archer see, Eddie? Rosie asks.
On the sole of the guy's shoe.
You want me to tell you? Eddie asks.
I think you'll be surprised.
No, says Rosie. I want to read it, the whole thing, and I want Archer's son to kill him and to tell him why while he's doing it.
You'll have to wait and see, says Eddie. I didn't think I'd ever finish it,
But then I've been sitting on private planes to South Carolina, to Hawaii. Sorry about Hawaii, says Rosie.
Nah, says Eddie. Got a lot of work done. And at least it wasn't Alaska.
You clever thing, says Rosie.
Then Ireland, then England, then Dubai. Nothing else to do but write.
And then you caught me, says Rosie.
Do you think anyone will read it? Says Eddie.
I think lots of people will read it, says Rosie. And I'm very lucky to be the first. After that, it's going straight to my agent. What's it called?
It doesn't have a title yet, says Eddie. I'm no good at titles. I want to name it after the guy with the shoe.
The killer, says Rosie.
Causes havoc wherever he goes.
And then some, says Eddie.
Then I've got a title for you, says Rosie.
Go on, says Eddie.
Write this down, says Rosie. A Cat Called Trouble.
Chapter 98. From Heathrow, Bonnie went straight back to her mum's, told her the job was cancelled. The look on her mum's face was awful, but imagine what that look might have been instead. Now, 3 days later, she, Felicity, and Tony are in Felicity's office. The hold all is gaping open on the floor between them, padlock cut open by the bolt cutters Tony bought from the B&Q just off junction 18 of the M25. The money they'd found inside is pulled up on Felicity's desk. Just over £1 million.
I just, starts Felicity, and hear me out here.
I just wonder what use it would be, Bonnie, handing it over to the police.
Bonnie looks at the money again.
That's your children's future sorted, says Tony.
But I didn't earn it, says Bonnie.
It's your bag, says Felicity. They gave it to you.
We have to report it, though, says Bonnie. I'm sorry, it's illegal.
I don't think money can be illegal, says Felicity. Not all by itself.
Tony nods.
It's not like a bag full of drugs. That's illegal.
That's illegal, confirms Felicity.
But it belongs to someone, says Bonnie.
A man called Mickey Moody, in fact, says Tony. Currently under arrest for murder.
Yes, says Felicity. And now it belongs to you. He couriered it over to your house, didn't he? And there's no note asking you to return it. And Mickey Moody was happy to see you risk going to jail in Brazil for the next 10 years, says Tony.
Precisely, says Felicity. He has other things on his mind. I don't suppose he'll miss this.
But what would I do with it? Bonnie asks.
I don't want it. I want to work.
Then work, says Felicity. Fly around the world with your mum and your kids. Build your brand. Spread some happiness.
But I don't know how, says Bonnie.
Then I'll be your agent, says Felicity.
You'll be my agent.
We can learn together and earn together, can't we?
And I can funnel this money through my accounts while we do.
Won't someone notice?
Well, I've had a good year, says Felicity. The tax man won't bat an eyelid.
Bonnie looks at them both.
But it's wrong.
Tony nods in understanding.
But there's an old saying, Bonnie. Two wrongs make a right.
I think, starts Felicity, looking at Tony, then lets it go.
Okay, says Bonnie. Okay then. But I'll be working for it.
You will, says Felicity. And I'll charge you 10%. Every penny of which will go to the families of Andrew Fairbanks, Bella Sanchez and Mark Gooch.
So you'll end up with nothing, Bonnie asks.
I was stupid, says Felicity. I should have known something was going on. And people died because I didn't want to look too closely. That's on me, I'm afraid. It's like when I didn't check Sue Lawley's contract properly in 1983 and she read the news for free for the first year.
What will I tell my mum, says Bonnie, and my kids?
You're going to work hard for the next few years, says Felicity, and you'll get paid for it. Just
a little more than the going rate, that's all. No one will ever know. And when the money runs out, we'll see where we are. If you make it, you make it. And if you don't make it, at least you tried.
It just, says Bonnie, it just doesn't seem right.
Bonnie, says Felicity, show business is full of people with rich parents. They can afford to struggle for a few years, knowing they have money behind them. Now, you don't have rich parents, but you have just been given a bag containing £1 million.
And tax-free, adds Tony, the best money of all.
Bonnie, says Felicity, I've been in this business a long time. I've seen talented people fail. I've seen morons become millionaires. There's no rhyme or reason to it. You need hard work, you need self-belief, and you need luck. You work hard, don't you?
So hard, says Bonnie, but I don't have self-belief.
You got on the train to come to see me, didn't you?
Well,
that's self-belief.
And then, says Tony, you were handed a bag containing £1 million in untraceable bills belonging to a man who will never ask for it back.
And that, says Felicity, is luck. Bonnie nods.
Okay, okay.
She looks at Felicity and Tony.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bonnie, says Felicity.
It's going to be fun.
But you two have got nothing out of this whole thing. Felicity and Tony look at each other, with a shrug from him and a giggle from her. Chapter 99.
A light red, I think, says Jeff, with monkfish.
No, white, says Hank, a rich white with monkfish.
Red would be more usual, says Jeff, running his finger down the list of red wines in the restaurant of the Wilberforce.
With monkfish, says Hank. Goodness me, Jeff, what a muddle you are getting yourself into.
Red, 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 says Jeff, reading down the menu.
Tell me when you get to the whites, says Hank.
Red, says Jeff.
White, says Hank.
Red, says Jeff.
I will give you gentlemen a moment to discuss, says the porter, waiting patiently. He then looks at Max's feet.
And I see that Sir has invested in some shoes.
Calfskin, says Max.
You see many calfskin shoes?
Oh, plenty, sir, says the porter. Most people just say leather, though.
The porter leaves the three men alone.
You two back together, then, says Max.
I don't see why not, says Hank.
Our suspicions got the better of us.
Max nods.
And then I caught Susan Knox for you.
Well, she used your name to cover up what she was doing, says Jeff, his nose wrinkling.
Come now, Jeff, says Hank, putting his hand on Jeff's arm. Let Max speak.
Yep, she messed with the wrong dude, says Max. You shoot for Max Highfield, you'd best not miss.
It was Amy Wheeler who caught her, starts Hank.
Come now, Hank, says Jeff. Let Max speak.
It was fine work, Max, says Hank.
Fine work.
And she used the name Joe Blow, too, says Max. From The Rose of Sarasota? People love that movie.
Although chosen for its obscurity, I think, says Jeff.
Did I tell you I'm going to be in a movie about money smuggling? Max says.
Rosie D'Antonio's movie, Jeff asks.
Yep, says Max.
So weird. It's just like what happened.
Jeff and Hank look at each other.
Let the man speak.
The last mystery to solve is why someone has been sending me death threats, says Max.
Hank always used to do that with new clients, says Jeff, so he could up the price when they were nice and terrified.
Yeah, says Max. In this case, a mystery, though.
And one we may never solve, says Hank.
Any recently?
None, says Max.
Hank shrugs at Jeff, and Jeff smiles.
The team is back.
The porter returns with a bottle of wine.
I took the liberty of bringing a rosé.
Oh, lovely, say Jeff and Hank together.
Chapter 100. From the cell of Mickey Moody.
All right, Susan. Don't know if you'll get this, but I read your name in the papers and thought I'd give it a whirl. No chat GPT when you're writing pen and ink, is there? What you see is what you get now. Mickey Moody, large as life and twice as ugly. I'm banged up, as you'll know, and fair enough too. I was stupid, and some other geezer was cleverer. That's the game, innit, Susan? Pissed me off, though. Thought I had it all worked out. Now I'm crapping in a bucket. Takes me back to my childhood. Sorry if I killed anyone you liked. And sorry they caught you, too. I hoped you'd get away with it, to be honest. Pictured you dipping your toes in the med or whatever. Still, Downview's not a bad prison. I had an aunt who did a 10 stretch there in the 90s, and she only said nice things. If I can give you some advice from one prison cell to another, it is this. No regrets. We live our lives forwards, not backwards. So always make the best of what's in front of you. You don't have to tell me, but I've got time on my hands. No telly, no golf. What's your story? Cheers, Mickey. Dear Mickey, I'm glad I didn't get away with it. I'm exactly where I belong. As for my story, it's the same as yours. The same as so many people's now. Money. I worked for Jeff Nolan, the man you tried to kill, and in the end, the man I tried to kill too. I had been topping up my salary for years and years from a few of Jeff's accounts. He gave me access to them over the years, so I could take care of things that bored him. Eventually, everything bored him. It was just a few thousand here and there at first, and I invested wisely. I sometimes even invested in things that Jeff told me to, actually, though he didn't realise it was his money I was using. I bought a few properties, but I always paid back what I'd taken from any profit that I made, and no harm was done to anyone. Recently, though, I'd started losing bits here and there. You know how interest rates have been, the global economy and such like. I had thought I was something of a financial genius, but I had merely been investing at a time when a fool could make money. And I am a fool. I started chasing my losses, and suddenly the money I could access from Jeff wasn't enough to cover what I was doing. And so I turned to you with my proposition, which I hoped would be lucrative and trouble-free. I'm not from a world of murder, Mickey. But I was desperate, and I accept that I walked through that door of my own free will. It was a mess, and it was a mess of my own making. So I have got everything I deserve. They have locked me up, and I hope they throw away the key. I will never forgive you for resorting to murder, Mickey, but that pales into insignificance against the fact that I will never forgive myself. Money does the funniest things to people, doesn't it? I know your job is to wash it clean, but, Mickey, how on earth do you wash yourself clean afterwards? I now have a long time to ponder that question. Sin in haste, repent at leisure. I have no interest in beginning a correspondence with you, so I shall bid you farewell and hope we both find some form of forgiveness. Yours sincerely, Susan Knox. Chapter 101. It is 3 a.m. and the village of Axley is grey-blue under a low moon. A lone pony stoops his head to drink from the village pond, and Steve Wheeler sits on his favourite bench. How many times has he sat here since Debbie died? talking to his wife, sharing his day, trying to hear the faint echo of a reply. "It's nice to be home," he says. The pony looks up. He knows Steve, of course. But who are the other two? "I think Debbie would be proud of you," says Amy, her head resting on Steve's shoulder. "I'm proud of you." "I'm proud of you too, Amy," says Steve. To Steve's left, Rosie D'Antonio mimes being sick, then downs the rest of a can of Red Stripe.
"Has anyone ever told you two that you're too sentimental?"
says the woman who just had a half-hour conversation with her boyfriend, says Amy.
"Eddie is not my boyfriend," says Rosie. "I'm mentoring him."
"We've all heard you mentoring him," says Amy, through the hotel walls. "Where to next, Amy?" Steve asks. "How do you mean?" "Mickey Moody and Susan Knox both under arrest. You're in the clear. So where are you headed? What's the next job?" Amy shrugs. "I think I'm done." Rosie cracks open another can. "Done?" asks Steve. "Jeff and Hank told me to take a couple of weeks off," says Amy. "I think I fancy a change." "Assassin?" suggests Rosie. Steve looks at Rosie. "You're going to put those cans in the recycling when you're done, aren't you?" Rosie raises her current can in cheers. "I'm not going to be done for a while yet, Stevie." "What will you do instead?" Steve asks. "Maybe something over here. I could see a bit more of you." "Detective agency," says Amy. "Investigations." "Competition, eh?" Steve laughs. "You'd be bored rigid, sitting in a car all day outside the Tesco Express in Lyndhurst." "I've got a different sort of agency in mind," says Amy. "Not so much investigating insurance fraud, more, you know, murders, stuff like that." "You're going to investigate murders?" Steve says. "You know, there's not a lot of call for it. I think the police have covered that market." "Not those murders," says Amy. "I mean the ones people can't solve. The ones people don't care about. The ones people give up on."
"People who can't protect themselves," says Steve.
And Amy looks at the ground and nods.
"Love it," says Rosie.
"And to pay for it all, we'll investigate a few murders on islands, murders in planes, that sort of thing too," says Amy. "Skyscraper murders."
"Good name for a book," starts Rosie.
"You'd need money," says Steve. "Offices, advertising, and you should see what I spend on photocopying." "I have a rich friend," says Amy. "Offered to put up $500,000 for a third of the company."
Rosie snorts. "You're setting up a detective agency and you didn't ask me first. I'll give you $750,000 for 20%.
"The other backer is a very close friend," says Amy.
"I'm a very close friend," says Rosie.
"But I shook hands," says Amy.
"Anything in writing?" Rosie asks.
"Well, no," says Amy. "But I don't like to go back on my word."
"That's business, baby," says Rosie.
"Final offer. $1,000,000 for 15%. We shake on it now."
"Deal," says Amy, and shakes Rosie's hand.
$1,000,000 for 15%.
"I should think so," says Rosie. "Who was the other offer from?"
"It was from you, after I told you the idea on the flight home from St. Lucia," says Amy. "I don't think I realised how high you were, but thank you for your counteroffer."
Rosie shakes her head. "Well played, Amy. Serves me right for mixing marijuana and tequila."
The pony ambles past, nodding to Steve as he goes. Steve nods back.
"If you ever need advice, you can always ask me," says Steve.
"I'll be at the bar of the Brass Monkey eating a microwave shepherd's pie."
"You'll be doing more than giving advice," says Amy, rubbing her finger over Debbie's plaque.
"You're my business partner."
Steve gives Amy's shoulder a squeeze.
God bless you for trying, Amy, but we both know that's not going to happen. I've had more than enough adventure lately, thank you.
You looked like you were enjoying yourself, says Rosie, if you want an observation.
I enjoyed spending time with Amy, says Steve. I didn't enjoy having to shoot people.
Yes, you did, says Rosie. You did, agrees Amy.
And I enjoyed watching you wearing shorts, says Rosie.
And I own 15% of this company, so I should have a say.
Come on, you'd love it.
I think I'm the best judge of what makes me happy, says Steve.
You know that's not true, says Rosie.
Says the woman who lives on a private island, says Steve.
You know you should buy a place over here, don't you? Have a bit of fun with actual friends.
I have a place over here already, says Rosie.
I'm almost certain.
Where is it? Amy asks.
I want to say Shaftesbury, says Rosie.
Is that nearby?
A337, A31, B3081, says Steve. 45 minutes with no traffic. Amy looks at the plaque on the bench.
Go on, says Amy. Dictaphone out. Ask her.
Steve takes his dictaphone from his pocket.
You know you can record messages on your phone now, says Rosie.
Have a chat, says Amy.
Rosie and I will go for a little wander while you do.
See the sights, says Rosie.
Talk about her new boyfriend, says Amy, and gets a punch from Rosie for her troubles.
Amy and Rosie stagger off, arm in arm. Steve is alone on his bench.
It is a very familiar feeling.
As they walk away, Rosie has clearly just told a dirty joke, probably about Eddie Flood, and his daughter-in-law is giggling. He presses play and starts to talk.
Hey, doll. Ridiculous one this evening. Amy wants me to go into business with her. Murder cases, you know, flying round the world, chasing bad guys. She told me to talk to you, but you'll know it's ridiculous too. I've got a business already, haven't I? I had a message about a lost cat only this morning. Who's going to find him if I'm in Monte Carlo or Finland or something? It's been nice spending time with Ames, but she'll come and visit. I've got the quiz every Wednesday, and I'd miss the gang at lunch if I was here, there and everywhere. Not to mention trouble. Who'd look after him when I went away? Well, Margaret, I know. Those two are in love with each other, but really I've got so much going on here. They're showing a film next week in the Village Hall. Men in Black 2, I think. That's the sort of thing I mean. And I like to sit here, Debs, that's the truth. I like to sit here and talk to you. And I know you've been with me, and we've seen a bit of the world. Steve can hear more laughter from Amy and Rosie as a ginger cat rolls around on the pavement in front of them. But it's crazy, Debs. Murders. Come on. Been there, done that. I'll stay here with you. Amy will understand. Steve is always hoping to hear Debbie reply. And this time, he does. He is certain of it. He reaches out his arm and feels her there. I understand, he says. I don't like it, but I understand. Rosie and Amy are making their way back to the bench. Rosie is carrying the ginger cat, who is purring very contentedly in her arms. Even the ginger cat is not immune to Rosie's fame. Steve realises, later than he should, that Rosie is not irresistible to people because she is famous. She is famous because she is irresistible to people. Amy and Rosie sit down on either side of him. The ginger cat gives Steve the eye as if to say, "Oh, it's you."
"What did Debbie say?" Amy asks.
"Say," laughs Steve. "She didn't say anything. I haven't lost my marbles."
Rosie puts a hand on his arm.
"Don't lie to us, Stevie."
"What did she say?" Steve bows his head, smiling.
Well, she swore at me for a while.
I'll bet, says Rosie.
And she told me to live, says Steve, because she doesn't have that choice anymore.
So you've got yourself a business partner.
Thanks, Debbie, says Amy.
Thanks, beautiful, agrees Steve. But I can work from home a lot, right?
Sure, says Amy, as and when.
And it'll take a while to drum up business, says Steve. I'll have a few weeks to potter around. They're showing a film next week at the Village Hall. It's Men in...
I got a text from Hank this morning, says Amy. A news presenter's been killed, and he's worried it's being covered up.
Nearby? Steve asks.
Fairly nearby, says Amy. Turkmenistan?
I'll prepare the jet, says Rosie.
Exciting, says Amy. The first case for Maverick Steel International Investigations.
Steve shakes his head. We're not going to be called Maverick Steel International Investigations.
It's bold, says Amy. It tells people who we are, what we represent, what they can expect.
Amy, says Steve, you're so great at punching people and shooting people and roundhouse kicks.
But you're very bad at naming companies, says Rosie.
We're not going to call a multi-million pound company Steve and Amy Investigate, says Amy.
Of course not, says Steve.
But the name of the company should tell people what we do.
Which is? Amy asks.
Steve spreads his hands, encompassing this team of three. We solve murders.
We solve murders.
Well, we do, says Steve, don't we?
Amy opens her mouth to complain, but thinks better of it. The pony is making its way up the high street, while the ginger cat snores lightly. Axley is still and quiet. She nods at Steve.
Okay, okay. We solve murders, it is.
Owls hoot their greetings from the trees.
We solve murders, says Rosie, nodding.
Great name for a book.
We hope you have enjoyed this Penguin audio production of We Solve Murders by Richard Osman, read by Nicola Walker. It was produced by Kate MacDonald, and the post-production was by Jack Beattie. For more Penguin audio productions, visit us at penguin.co.uk/audio. Text copyright, Richard Osman, 2024. Copyright and recording, Penguin Audio, 2024. All rights reserved. The moral rights of the author have been asserted. Thanks for listening.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.